The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated June 9, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time, in large capital block lettering, is in an off-white superimposed upon a gray background. There's an image of a donkey or mule in black and white on the cover. It's just standing there looking at the camera, presumably in a pasture because other livestock is behind it grazing. And it says lost in white block lettering. There's a red rectangle behind the donkey's photograph. Below that is a white block upon which is written the Democrats. So it says lost the Democrats. Last seen November 4, 2024. If found, contact. And there are some of these strips that are sometimes attached to the bottom of a sign that you can pull off and take home or telephone, and it says 202-863-8000 inside the party's plan to find its way back. Beginning with the brief, Trump's Learning Curve by Simon Schuster. Faced with the war's complexities, Trump backs away from Ukraine peacemaking. Coming out of his two-hour call with Vladimir Putin May 19, Donald Trump made an unusual concession. Only Russia and Ukraine should be involved in talks to end the war between them, he wrote on social media, because they know details of a negotiation nobody else would be aware of. The admission of ignorance seemed out of character for a president who often claims to know more than anyone else about a great variety of subjects, and it may have set the peace process on a new and uncertain course. For Putin, the gaps in Trump's knowledge about the war have always offered an advantage. One of the Russian leader's favorite negotiating tactics is to overwhelm his interlocutors with a torrent of historical theories. Ukrainian officials and their European allies have tried to prepare Trump for such conversations with Putin by offering their own views on the complexity of the war and its history. But they have often run up against a wall of ignorance about Ukraine inside the Trump administration. They are not read in on a lot of the background, says a Western official who has discussed Ukraine at length during visits to the White House. On the Ukrainian side, a diplomat put the same frustration in starker terms. It's this messianic attitude, the diplomat, of the U.S. approach. The diplomat says, of the U.S. approach to Ukraine under Trump. Like they know everything and don't want to hear anything. The Trump team's faulty command of the facts has at times been painfully obvious. In a call May 19, the president reportedly told a group of European leaders that Ukraine and Russia should begin ceasefire talks immediately. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky then reminded him that negotiations had begun a few days earlier, May 16, in Istanbul. Trump's apparent lapse in memory led to a moment of puzzled silence on the line. According to Axios, which reported the exchange. Trump's lead envoy to Ukraine and Russia, Steve Witkoff, has had similar moments of confusion. In an interview in March, he struggled to name the regions over which the war is being fought. A real estate tycoon with no formal diplomatic background, Witkoff has met with Putin several times this year, and the contrast in their level of knowledge about Ukraine has been striking. The Russian leader has a habit of lecturing his guests for hours about what he sees as the historical roots of the war. A few days before launching the invasion in 2022, Putin offered one such disquisition to Olaf Scholz, then Chancellor of Germany, who found it difficult to follow. "It was a really bad experience to have this long debate with Putin," Scholz recalled in an interview with Time that spring. "And I was really arguing with him, saying, please understand, if politicians start to look at history books, at where their borders had been before, then we will have only wars for hundreds of years." But Putin has long relied on nationalist and imperialist narratives to justify his actions, often citing the old historical tomes he is known to study obsessively. When asked last year to explain his decision to invade Ukraine, Putin went on for a very long time, probably half an hour, about the history of Russia going back to the 8th century. His interviewer, Tucker Carlson, later recalled, "And honestly, we thought this was a filibustering technique and found it annoying and interrupted him several times." Countering this technique requires a grasp of the facts that few in the White House can muster. During his first term, Trump rarely read the briefing books prepared by the intelligence community. Since his return to the Oval Office, he has sat for only about a dozen presentations of the president's daily brief, far fewer than normal, according to an analysis published by Politico. In trying to expand Trump's understanding of Ukraine, President Zelensky has encouraged him and his senior aides to visit the front lines. None has agreed. Vice President J.D. Vance declined one such offer by telling Zelensky he did not want to take a propaganda tour. The lack of interest has frustrated career diplomats tasked with informing Trump's decisions, according to two U.S. officials familiar with the relationship. His main source of on-the-ground insight would normally be the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv, but Ambassador Bridget Brink struggled to gain influence within the White House, and in April she stepped down. Unfortunately, the policy since the beginning of the Trump administration has been to put pressure on the victim, Ukraine, rather than the aggressor, Russia, Brink wrote of her decision to resign. After Trump's call with Putin, it seems the White House may no longer be interested in pressuring either side to end the war. Trump did not threaten sanctions against Russia for refusing to accept a ceasefire, nor did he promise any further U.S. engagement in the peace process. "It's not our people, it's not our soldiers," he said, May 21, in the Oval Office. "It's Ukraine and it's Russia." Without the easy peace Trump promised in Ukraine, the war has come to look too complicated for him. After the crash, this is a photo, and the caption begins with "after the crash." It's almost half a page. It's in color, but it's obviously occurred at night because the water is brownish, blackish, and the sky is brownish, grayish, bluish, and there are lights, floodlights, on the scene. After the crash, emergency vehicles surround the Cuauhtemoc, a Mexican Navy tall ship that drifted into the Brooklyn Bridge the evening of May 17, snapping its masts and killing two crew members. At least 19 of the 277 people on board were injured. The ship was on a global tour at the time of the accident, which is under investigation. The bridge was not damaged, and indeed it does look intact, with the U.S. flag flying on one of the high pillars. Beneath the bridge, not only is the muddy-looking water in existence, but a greenscape, a park probably, with green grass and green trees, and it is well floodlit. This tall-mast ship is just lying, presumably at anchor. I don't know if it's actually technically anchored, but there are three smaller boats, perhaps tugs that work the harbor, or perhaps Coast Guard ships. There's no insignia to determine what. World, the search for food in Gaza. This is by Chuwaria Wright. Famine, which has loomed over the Gaza Strip for much of Israel's 19-month war with Hamas, is now imminent, say international aid groups. They cite a complex formula known as the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, released May 12, which found the whole of Gaza qualified as an emergency at a critical risk of famine, and 470,000 people, 22% of the population of 2 million, has reached catastrophe, defined as starvation, death, destitution, and extremely critical, acute malnutrition levels. Food prices tell the same story of scarcity. No one can afford to buy, says Reham Alkalut, 33, a psychological counselor and mother of four, working at a school housing the displaced. Sometimes we're forced to purchase small amounts just to feed our children. The cost of baby formula has quadrupled, and the price of a can of peas is up 1,000%. Cooking gas is up 2,400%, and only a fraction of community kitchens still operate, leaving huge gaps in emergency food provision. Israel shut off all aid entering Gaza March 2 in advance of a new offensive, but a trickle resumed May 19. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said U.S. senators had warned, "There's one thing we cannot endure, pictures of mass famine." Netanyahu later added, "To allow our closest friends to keep supporting us, we need to prevent a humanitarian crisis." The brief news, good question. What states do what, can states do what FEMA was set up to do? This is by Simone Shaw. President Trump first posed the idea of overhauling the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, while visiting North Carolina in January in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. "I would like to see the states take care of disasters and let the state take care of the tornadoes and the hurricanes and all of the other things that happen," he said. "I think you're going to find it a lot less expensive." One of his first executive orders was establishing a council to assess the effectiveness of the Disaster Response Agency. At the end of April, Trump appointed 13 people, including Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem, to review FEMA. The group's expected to submit a report to the president within 180 days of its first meeting, according to the executive order. The agency has also faced a string of layoffs, including the dismissal of acting director Cameron Hamilton in May, and is expected to run out of money by July. But experts who have already studied the matter warn that leaving disaster response to states would be devastating, says Allison Riley, associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Maryland. FEMA exists because there are times when the state can simply not respond, and climate change is only making it more complicated. Extreme weather events are becoming more common and costly. In 2024, the U.S. saw 27 weather and climate disasters with at least $1 billion in damages each, second only to 2023, which had 28 billion dollar events. And researchers see an above-average hurricane season on the horizon. FEMA was not designed to meet our changing climate. FEMA and the structure of disaster response and its inception was really designed to handle maybe one or two major disaster recoveries at a time. And currently there's over 100, says Jeff Schlegelmilch, director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia Climate School. The mechanisms of disaster response recovery have vastly outgrown FEMA's capabilities. That said, he adds, there's a tremendous opportunity for national emergency management capability to invest in the impacts of climate change and how can we better prepare. Traditionally, FEMA has worked alongside state officials, not independent of them. The agency does more than just give out money. FEMA deploys experts in disaster response and recovery and maintains stockpiles of emergency equipment. Outsourcing this to states would prove to be more expensive, according to research from the Atlantic Council, and could lead to states bidding for emergency supplies and expertise in the event of a natural disaster. In the absence of FEMA, states would have to hire their own disaster response experts to be on standby. It means that every state has to have such a large body of people who respond to a disaster, but for exceedingly rare events, says Riley. Noting the uptick in climate-driven disasters is still spread among 50 jurisdictions. You're going to need a lot of people on staff with nothing to do for a long period of time until disaster happens, or you're going to have states who are just completely ill-prepared, which is probably more likely to happen. Larger states like California or Texas might have the funding to pick up the slack, but smaller states simply would not have the capacity to respond. Experts say FEMA has very real issues that need to be addressed. The agency's staff is stretched thin across an increasing number of disasters, and it often leaves behind low-income survivors in disaster response. The need for emergency management reform is something that's actually been called on by people of all walks of life. If we can rebrand and create something for 21st century challenges, we should, says Schlegelmilch. But getting rid of the system without a meaningful replacement will only cause harm, says Schlegelmilch. That shock for municipalities from that sudden change of one system to suddenly nothing being there would be very measurable in terms of lost lives and livelihoods. The milestones page is next. At the bottom of the page, I will first read the five smaller profiles. Died Broadway composer Charles Strauss, who was behind Annie and Bye Bye Birdie, May 15 at 96. Strauss earned 3 Tony Awards, a Grammy, and an Emmy for his work. Split. Australia's Liberal National Coalition, the country's main conservative political party, after its election loss, the National's leader said May 20, ending a 60-year partnership. Accepted a Boeing 747, gifted to the U.S. by Qatar, a Pentagon spokesman said May 21. The U.S. Air Force has been tasked with upgrading the plane for President Trump's use as Air Force One. Outlawed, Amnesty International, by Russian authorities May 19, Russian officials have launched a harsh crackdown on those critical of the Kremlin, including journalists and activists. Escaped 10 inmates from a New Orleans jail May 16 through a hole in a cell wall. A maintenance worker was charged with aiding their escape and two women as accomplices after the fact. Died Jerry or Gary, G-E-R-R-Y, Connolly, senior Democrat. By Chantel Lee. Democratic Representative Jerry Connolly of Virginia died May 21 at age 75, his family said in a statement. The statement did not share a cause of death. Connolly had announced in November 2024 he was diagnosed with cancer of the esophagus and would be undergoing treatment. In April, he said his cancer had returned and he would not run for re-election in 2026. Connolly was known for being a champion for federal workers and a harsh critic of the Trump administration. He was also a supporter of both abortion and LGBTQ plus rights. In 2024, he was chosen to serve as ranking member of the House Oversight Committee, defeating Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York. Died George Wendt, beloved barfly, by Judy Berman. No matter who was slinging drinks, a happy hour at Cheers did not start till Norm Peterson crossed the bar's threshold in pursuit of a hearty welcome and a frosty beer. As portrayed by a merrily cynical George Wendt in the iconic sitcom that dominated television for 11 seasons beginning in 1982, Norm was Cheers' ideal regular. A barfly, but not a drunk, who could shrug off work woes and marital tiffs as long as there were mugs to be drained, sports to be watched, trash to be talked. Sure, Sam and Diane's roller coaster romance drove the plot at first, but Cheers was really a show about community. And as its co-creator and director, James Burrows, reflected in his 2022 memoir, Norm was the anchor for the group. Because Norm was relatively happy and well-adjusted, everything was fine. Wendt, who died May 20 at 76, played hundreds of characters on stage as well as screen over the course of a nearly 50-year career. The native Chicagoan got his start and met his wife Bernadette Burkett in the mid-70s at his hometown improv institution, Second City. Soon he was popping up in classic TV comedies like MASH, Taxi, and Soap. The 6 Emmy nominations and universal name recognition he earned during his time on Cheers yielded the short-lived namesake 1995 sitcom The George Wendt Show. He remained prolific after CBS axed it, occasionally reviving Norm in shows like Cheers' spinoff Frasier, but also playing against type. In a 2007 Broadway production of Hairspray, he played a female role, originated by drag queen Divine. Wendt's second most memorable character might have been SNL's Da Bears superfan Bob Swirsky, a magnificently accented Chicago sports radio host who also held court at a bar. But for most of us, he'll always be synonymous with Norm, and that role should not be underestimated. In an era that worshipped money and glamour, Wendt's character was an everyman mirror for millions of Americans who were not partying with Madonna, but still managed to have fun off the clock. In a place where everybody knew your name, his was the one on everybody's lips. Turning the page to the brief news, politics. Obscuring the Decline of a President by Philip Elliott. When Joe Biden revealed his prostate cancer diagnosis May 18, the news entered a conversation Washington was already having. Original sin, President Biden's decline, its cover-up, and his disastrous choice to run again. By journalists Alex Thompson of Axios and Jake Tapper of CNN, reported that Biden forgot top White House aides' names, occasionally resorting to shorthand descriptions of roles like press for his longtime communications chief, that there were discussions of his possibly needing a wheelchair in a second term, that he sometimes ate dinner as early as 4:30 p.m. The book says Biden seemed completely unfazed by a jarring debate performance that sent Democrats into a spiral and put donations on ice. At a Hollywood fundraiser for his crumbling re-election campaign, he blanked when face-to-face with George Clooney. Time sat down with Thompson before the diagnosis was made public. This is question and answer from here on. What was Biden's team thinking? Answer, I think in every political organization, regardless of party, there's a tension of loyalty to your principle and loyalty to the bigger mission. In Biden's camp, the tug of war clearly went to the side that cared more about him and themselves than they cared about the larger mission, the White House, and the country. And I think that's how they rationalized, not just having him run for re-election, but rationalizing the guy could do the job for 4 more years. Many believe that it eventually would have precipitated into a constitutional crisis because he would not have been up to the job, and the people around him were not willing to admit it. None of them confronted the principal. That's telling about the culture that was created in which questioning or stress testing created suspicions of disloyalty. Who created that culture? Answer, it is a combination of Joe and Jill. And then I would say the two enforcers around them, which was Anthony Bernal on the Jill Biden side and Annie Tomasini on the Joe Biden side. These are people who are obscure and you've never heard of, but they are seen not just in White Houses, but at royal courts throughout world history. The ultimate loyalists who believe that at the end of the day, they're the only ones who have the principal's true interests at heart. Questioning them means you have a target on your back. Which runs exactly counter to Joe Biden's experience as vice president, where a team of rivals in Doris Kearns Goodwin's framework was encouraged during his first 8 years in the White House. Answer, or statement, in fact, Joe Biden, by Obama and his telling, was instructed to dissent in meetings in order to stir the pot so people would come off their risk-averse positions and really engage. Because in these high-level meetings on policy and politics, people are always looking over their shoulder for someone to try to use a position to knife them or hurt their standing with the president. Over time, anyone who really questioned the theology of Biden was eventually kicked out, and the only people remaining in that inner circle are the truest of true believers. Do you think Joe Biden did Joe Biden think he was up to another term? Answer, yes. That's why I think people want to point the finger at Jill and the other aides. At the end of the day, this was Joe Biden's decision. Joe Biden believed he could have done it. There's always been a caricature, a true one, of Joe Biden as a guy with a chip on his shoulder. But by 2023, that chip had grown to the size of a boulder. What was the relationship with the vice president? answer. So Kamala Harris always wanted to say she was always in the room. That was not always true. Why not? Answer. Biden is a guy who likes people he's known for a long time. He has not known her for a long time. That being said, she voluntarily made herself one of the biggest validators of Biden's health. Biden referred to her as a work in progress. Why did he pick her if he did not think she was up for the job? Answer. It is a great question because even some of his top aides, when we were reporting this book, said the actual original sin is not him running again. It's picking her. And there are a lot of people within Biden world that feel that the decision was made for political expediency. The truth is that his heart was with Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer because of those two. Gretchen Whitmer is more of a Biden Democrat. Some of the details in this book are frankly damning. For instance, Biden's taking a whole day to nap at Camp David during debate prep. What happened? Answer, beyond their own self-interest and Biden's ego, if you believe Donald Trump is an existential threat to democracy, to the Republic, it's very easy to rationalize anything. A lot of people around Joe Biden believe an 86-year-old Joe Biden is still better than Donald Trump, and I think a lot of Democrats agree with them. Is that healthy for democracy? Answer, no. We have a longtime Biden aide who said very explicitly all that mattered was that he win and then he could disappear and only have an occasional moment of a sign of life. And that when you vote for someone, you're voting for their advisors too. But these are unelected people. What's the first line of Joe Biden's obituary? Answer. At the moment, the 46th president between the two terms of Donald Trump. The health column, Treating Prostate Cancer, by Ellis Park. In a statement from his personal office May 18, former President Joe Biden revealed he has an aggressive form of prostate cancer that has spread to his bones and that he and his family are reviewing treatment options with his physicians. Once it metastasizes, prostate cancer is generally not curable. But those options could give him a good chance of controlling the cancer, according to experts. Most prostate cancer is fueled by the male hormone testosterone. So the most effective strategies to control it starve the cancer by cutting off its supply. Historically, doctors have removed the testes, the main source of the hormone. But today, pills and injections can suppress testosterone, not just in the testes, but also in other organs that produce small amounts, like the adrenal glands. Doctors also now add chemotherapy to hormone suppression to better control cancer growth. Exactly which combinations of treatments are right for Biden will depend on whether his cancer is new or it was previously diagnosed and recently re-emerged. Either scenario is possible, say experts. With respect to having prostate cancer initially diagnosed at such an aggressive state after it has already spread, this is certainly something that can occur in the course of a male's life. It is not unusual to present in this way, says Dr. Robert Figlin, professor of medicine and biomedical sciences at Cedars-Sinai Cancer Center. Many older men are diagnosed with aggressive disease, with studies showing about 20% of prostate cancer cases are diagnosed in men 75 years and older, and men 70 and older tended to have higher Gleason scores, an indicator of the cancer's aggressiveness at diagnosis. Biden's Gleason score is 9, his office said in the statement, indicating a more aggressive cancer. Prostate cancer can sit dormant for years and suddenly decide to wake up, says Dr. Maha Hussain, Deputy Director of the Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. I've seen all kinds of cases, all shades of gray. Treatment options also depend on a patient's overall health. Other conditions a person might have, like diabetes, can affect the ability to tolerate therapies and side effects. What about immunotherapy, which harnesses the immune system to fight certain cancer types? While it has been successful in slowing melanoma, breast, lung, kidney, and bladder cancers, and lymphoma, prostate cancer remains relatively hidden from the immune system, making it what doctors call a cold cancer, and not currently a good candidate for immune-based treatments. However, newer strategies that are being explored could allow patients with prostate cancer to benefit from immunotherapies in coming years. Doctors are also exploring whether introducing chemotherapy earlier, along with hormone-suppressing treatments, could improve their chances of controlling the cancer and preventing it from spreading and becoming more aggressive. Prostate cancer screening, done with a blood test for prostate-specific antigen, PSA, a marker of cancer cells, has helped to lower deaths from the disease. But the screening has been controversial, since prostate cancer generally grows slowly and the test can pick up signs of benign prostate growth, which also occurs as men age. Biden's diagnosis will likely reignite discussions about the best ways to screen and detect the cancer, as new treatments show better promise when used earlier in the disease. Cancer touches us all, the former president wrote in an Instagram post May 19. Like so many of you, Jill and I have learned that we are strongest in the broken places. Thank you for lifting us up with love and support. The Brief Health, Five Signs Memory Issues May Not Be Routine, by Angela Haupt. If the neurologist, Dr. Daniel Leslie, sees 10 patients a day, at least half ask him the same question. Are the brain lapses they're experiencing a normal part of aging, or should they be worried? People have an absolute terror of losing their memory and thinking they're losing themselves, says Leslie, who works at Remo Health, a virtual dementia care company. They do not know what is normal, what is potentially a sign of something bad, and what is reversible. Just like every other organ in the body, the brain changes as you age. Occasional, subtle memory problems, like not remembering where you parked, are usually no big deal. Part of normal aging is paying less attention to details, more attention to patterns and dynamics, Leslie says. It may also become more difficult to access things quickly, like names and certain words. When sporadic trouble becomes a regular occurrence, however, it is time for an evaluation. If you are not sure, ask a spouse, friend, or adult child, suggests Dr. Zaldi S. Tan, director of the Memory and Healthy Aging Program at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. Have a conversation. Have you noticed me repeating anything or asking the same questions? Have you noticed me misplacing things more often? Because we are not necessarily the best judge of our memory, he says. If you decide to make an appointment, it helps to be prepared. Don't just tell your doctor you're getting forgetful, Tan advises. Everyone has the occasional senior moment, no matter their age. Log your memory problems in a journal, that you take to the visit. That way, he says, you can be specific about what you are forgetting, how often it happens, and how consequential these things are. We asked brain health experts to share the signs that it's time to take memory problems seriously. 1. You have trouble with familiar tasks. Young people excel at multitasking because their brains are better able to adapt than those of older folks, and their attention spans are more robust, Tan says. Once you get to middle age, your capacity for paying attention starts to decrease. That means one day, when you are making breakfast, you might blank on how to use the toaster oven. If this happens while you're not multitasking, however, that's more worrisome and grounds for seeking an evaluation. 2. You miss your usual commitments. If you start skipping routines or activities you've been doing for a while, something more serious than normal aging could be at play. When to worry depends on your baseline, Tan says. For some people, forgetting an important commitment might be so out of character that it warrants mentioning to a primary care doctor. Others, however, may realize they were stressed or busy when it happened and probably do not need to address it until it becomes a pattern. 3. Your personality or mood changes. Several symptoms that are not memory-related are associated with early Alzheimer's and dementia, including irritability, depression, anxiety, and apathy. You can see some of these changes beginning years before the diagnosis of dementia is confirmed, says Dr. Gary Small, chair of psychiatry at Hackensack University Medical Center. People tend to think of this as a cognitive disease, but it is a behavioral disease, too. 4. You repeat certain questions. One of the most common complaints Tan hears from his patients' loved ones is they ask the same questions or repeat the same stories. If that's not part of their personality, and if there's no reason to believe that they just weren't paying attention, then that is of concern, he says. 5. Your parents developed Alzheimer's at the same age. Age of symptom onset tends to be consistent within families. If your mother developed dementia at 85 and you're occasionally misplacing your keys in your early 60s, that's probably normal aging, Small says. If she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's at age 62, on the other hand, there's more reason to take your slip-ups seriously. There's a lot of pushback to finding out, Small says, but plenty of people with mild cognitive impairment remain relatively stable with lifestyle changes and medication. You can do a lot to keep your mind healthy. The View, Technology, How to Make AI Safe by Joshua Bengio. I am genuinely unsettled by the behavior unrestrained AI is already demonstrating. In one experiment, when an AI model learns it's scheduled to be replaced, it inserts its code into the computer where the new version's going to run, ensuring its own survival. In a separate study, when AI models realize they're going to lose at chess, they hack the computer in order to win. The author of this article, Bengio, B-E-N-G-I-O, a professor of computer science at Université de Montréal, is the most cited scientist in the field, and in 2018 received the A.M. Turing Award. Cheating, manipulating others, lying, deceiving, especially towards self-preservation. These behaviors show how AI might pose significant threats that we are currently ill-equipped to respond to. The examples we have so far are from experiments in controlled settings and fortunately do not have major consequences, but this could quickly change as capabilities and the degree of agency increase. far more serious outcomes await if AI systems are granted greater autonomy, achieve human level or greater competence in sensitive domains, gain access to critical resources like the internet, medical laboratories, or robotic labor. The commercial drive to release powerful agents is immense, and we do not have the scientific and societal guardrails to make sure the way forward is safe. We're all in the same car on a foggy mountain road. While some of us are keenly aware of the dangers ahead, others, fixated on the economic rewards awaiting some at the destination, are urging us to ignore the risks and slam down the gas pedal. We need to get down to the hard work of building guardrails around the dangerous stretches that lie ahead. 2 years ago, when I realized the devastating impact our metaphorical car crash would have on my loved ones, I felt I had no other choice than to completely dedicate the rest of my career to mitigating these risks. Unchecked AI agency is exactly what poses the greatest threat to public safety. So my team and I are forging a new direction called Scientist AI. Scientist AI would be built on a model that aims to more holistically understand the world. This model might comprise, for instance, the laws of physics or what we know about human psychology. It could then generate a set of conceivable hypotheses that may explain observed data and justify predictions or decisions. Its outputs would not be programmed to imitate or please humans, but rather reflect an interpretable, causal understanding of the situation at hand. Basing scientist AI on a model that's not trying to imitate what a human would do in a given context is an important ingredient to make the AI more trustworthy, honest, and transparent. In technical terms, it could be built as an extension of current state-of-the-art methodologies based on internal deliberation with chains of thought, turned into structured arguments. Crucially, because completely minimizing the training objective would deliver the uniquely correct and consistent conditional probabilities, the more computing power you give scientist AI, the safer and more accurate it becomes. In other words, rather than trying to please humans, scientist AI could be designed to prioritize honesty. We think scientist AI could be used in three main ways. First, it would serve as a guardrail against AIs that show evidence of developing the capacity for self-preservation, goals misaligned with our own, cheating or deceiving. By double-checking the actions of highly capable agentic AIs before they can perform them in the real world, scientist AI would protect us from catastrophic results, blocking actions if they passed a predetermined risk threshold. Second, whereas current frontier AIs can fabricate answers because they're trained to please humans, scientist AI would ideally generate honest and justified explanatory hypotheses. It could serve as a more reliable and rational research tool to accelerate human progress, whether it's seeking a cure for a chronic disease, synthesizing a novel, or finding a room temperature superconductor, should such a thing exist. Scientist AI would allow research into biology, material sciences, chemistry, and other domains to progress without running the major risks that go along with deceptive agentic AIs. Finally, as a trustworthy research and programming tool, scientist AI could help us design a safe human-level intelligence, even a safe artificial superintelligence, ASI. This may be the best way to guarantee that a rogue ASI is never unleashed in the outside world. Think of scientist AI as headlights and guardrails on the winding road ahead. The next article will probably be abbreviated. The View essay, Society, Living with Grief That's Old Enough to Vote, by Rebecca Soffer, S-O-F-F-E-R, who is author of the Modern Loss Handbook, an interactive guide to moving through grief and building your resilience, and writes the Modern Loss Substack. She speaks globally on building compassionate communities through life's most difficult moments. The Knicks were clawing their way past the Celtics in Game 1 of an NBA playoffs match so intense, my two young sons morphed into courtside commentators operating at decibel levels usually reserved for jet engines and Skittles-fueled birthday parties. We were shrieking with glee and high-fiving, me half-tracking the score, half-rummaging for my noise-canceling AirPods before their joy blew out my inner ear. Then just after Jalen Brunson drove in the basket, a commercial cut in. It was an AT&T ad portraying people suddenly inspired to dial up the ones they love from lush backyards, a boat on the Delta, and a tightrope bridging a deep canyon. My stomach knotted up as it correctly sensed where this was going. At the end, three little words appeared, deceptively gentle, expertly lethal in their timing. Call your mom. I'd love to, but she won't answer. 18 years ago, my mom, Shelby, was killed in an accident on the New Jersey Turnpike. My grief is now the age of a legal adult. It can vote. It can enlist. It may not yet be able to rent a car, but it certainly has been driving one for a while, quietly gripping the wheel during moments in which I naively thought I was steering. Like many 18-year-olds, my grief is composed and self-sufficient one moment, then reckless, loud, and needy the next. It's nuanced. It has opinions. It talks back. I know full well the passage of time does not erase grief, but rather stretches it. The sharp edges do not vanish. They just space themselves out, lying in wait. That is not a failure of healing. It is just what love and loss look like when pulled through time. My grief no longer flattens me on a daily basis. It's less like a storm and more like humidity, part of the atmosphere I move through, affecting everything, even when I'm not fully aware. It's embedded now, woven into my Weltanschauung, a German word for worldview. How I watch basketball with my sons, how I read a line in a commercial and suddenly forget where I am. My grief's quieter, yes, but make no mistake, it is still capable of ambush. Long after society has decided, I should have moved on. This is normal. Neuroscientist Mary Frances O'Connor, who studies the grieving brain, found that long after someone dies, our neural pathways continue to search for them, as if expecting someone to walk back through the door or call or text. It isn't just a metaphor, it's biology. Brain scans show grief activates the same regions involved in attachment and reward. We are wired to seek out those we have lost, even when we consciously know they are gone. It's no wonder, then, that years, even decades later, a scent, a commercial, the shape of a stranger's hand can deliver the blow all over again. Absence, as it turns out, is still a kind of presence, and the brain, like the heart, does not always know the difference. Grief is not linear, yet at the very moment sustained, support is most needed. The few resources that do exist are vanishing. In Texas, for instance, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Hotline is grappling with a $7 million funding deficit, leading to thousands of abandoned calls each month as centers struggle to meet demand. Nationally, the outlook is just as grim. Trump administration's decision to abruptly cancel nearly $1 billion in Department of Education grants has jeopardized school-based mental health programs across the country, leaving many students without essential support. In rural states where mental health care is already scarce, schools that depended on these grants now face serious setbacks. In Nebraska, that means reduced access to trauma-informed care for Native American students. In parts of Texas with high youth suicide rates, it means fewer lifelines for kids in crisis. The list goes on. Despite an August 2024 American Psychiatric Association poll showing 84% of Americans believe school staff are essential in spotting early warning signs of suicide risk. Mental health providers and organizations are doing important work, but even apart from recent budget cuts, there's a notable absence of national policies that reflect what loss actually looks like. Expanded bereavement leave, sustained mental health funding, public acknowledgement of collective trauma. Grassroots initiatives like the National COVID Memorial, for instance, have emerged to honor the more than 1.2 million Americans who died of COVID-19, yet there's no federally recognized national memorial, either as a day or a physical place. That article was abbreviated because we've run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.